want to break into the system.
Someone without access to the exam.
I have been doing a little hacking in here, isn't it, right?
Computers and the programs will start thinking, and the people will stop.
I still don't understand why you want to break into the system.
Because, man, somewhere in one of these memories is the evidence that I got in front of, I can reconstruct it.
All right, everyone, welcome to the August 24th edition of the In The Now show. This is your host, Slip Mode, along with
Rusty.
And I told you guys on the last show I tried to make time to get Rusty in here, and I finally did. He's a good friend of mine locally here in Phoenix. And did a article recently in the New Times about wireless. And we're going to talk about that later. But let's go into our usual subjects we've been covering lately, which is the SCO topic. We're going to talk about the new Microsoft Blaster Worm and some other things. So, how you been doing, Rusty?
I've been doing pretty good.
Cool, yeah? Okay, this is a very interesting story. It's about a guy that disclosed some security vulnerability in a system and might even go to jail for it. He didn't even do anything illegal. Basically, he explained how the vulnerability worked, and what it was just a vulnerability in the mail system. It was a webmail system, and basically, he showed how you can grab the session ID of that person's session and basically read their email. And the software said that the email was secure from things like that, but he decided to disclose it, and he could possibly be going to jail. It's up to a judge to figure out how to interpret this law that does says it is illegal to disclose security vulnerabilities, and I don't know what the outcome is yet, but it's definitely interesting. So what do you think about that, Rusty? I mean, come on, people do that all the time, you know. Like even at my school, we started doing, you know, something against said site, and watched how it reacted, and you know, could that be, you know? I mean, it wasn't malicious, so.
Yeah, I think the precedent set forth in this case could be very bad if he's convicted of committing a crime. Look at the full disclosure mailing list. Look at how the security community works in a whole. I mean, if you post a vulnerability to a mailing list, it's suddenly going to be illegal. I see that as being wrong. I mean.
Yeah, I mean that was one of the things I read about is like. Yeah, anybody, you know, I mean, just from common sense, anybody else that starts disclosing things, I mean, could potentially be considered, you know, doing something illegal, which, to me, that's our best tool for trying to figure out what's going on, is people, you know, sharing the knowledge. Otherwise, it's just going to be a select few that know about said vulnerability, problem, whatever, and it's never going to be released, and the only people that are actually going to be able to use that knowledge, because you can't use it to fix the problem, you're going to be using that knowledge to abuse the problem. So very bad thing. Also, another interesting thing, a popular Java Anonymous proxy, the JAP, basically has been backdoored, according to this article. It's used to anonymize one's comings and goings across the internet and has been backordered by court order. The service is currently logging access attempts to a particular and unnamed website and reporting the IP addresses of one of those who attempt to contact it to the German police. And the article says, we know this because the JAP operators immediately warn users that their IP traffic might be going to the straight Big Brother. Right or wrong. After taking the service down after a few days, the explanation that the interruption was due to a hardware failure, and the operators then required users to install an upgraded version, basically the backdoored version, of the app to continue using the service. Well, that just sucks. But you know what? At least it's getting out that it's backdoored. I mean, but how many other things out there, you know, could be backdoored that you don't know about? I don't. We talked about. I think it was the last show we talked about how GNU.org got rooted, and they had access for a few months. They did go through some measures to validate the packets, not the packets, the packages, the source code, the you know, everything on the site, and try to make sure that everything is original, legit to when they knew there wasn't a compromise, and supposedly everything looks to be okay, but you know, you never know. Like when I was at that presentation at DEF CON, the government IP wiretapping, you know, I was told that Cisco is going to make it a little easier in their iOS to incorporate, you know, tracking features of internet traffic and stuff like that, making it a little bit easier. So, you know, it's been done with telephones and, you know, they have people listening on the airwaves, and now they've got, now they're tackling the market of covering IP. So, like we said before, if you're going to be doing anything, the best thing to do is try to encrypt as much traffic and as much as you can possibly encrypt, whether it be your traffic, your email, and also if you are doing something you don't want somebody to be watching, try to do it as anonymous as possible. So it's always always problematic, Big Brother out there. Okay, moving right along. This is something I didn't even know about that was happening. I guess this was something that has been going on for a while now. And Microsoft lost $521 million in a case over the Internet Explorer browser. If anyone's ever opened up IE and, like, hit, you know, had a PDF file automatically open in the file, or had, like, an Internet Explorer, I mean, not Internet Explorer, but a Microsoft Excel file, a Microsoft Word file, opening up various programs, file formats within IE. Well, there's a company called Eolas Technologies, basically charged Microsoft that they violated a patent for their web browser technology that allows other mini applications to work with the Internet Explorer browser. So I guess they beat them to the patent and got $521 million out of the settlement. So that's quite, that's half a billion dollars.
Yeah, that's a good thing. They don't need that money anyways, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, it's definitely not going towards security or anything that's important. That was my little bash. But, you know, we're going to lead into something that's even going to, you know, support that, even though we've already supported it in the past. Well, the I think a lot of people already know about it. The worm that's been heading out around on the Internet for the last few weeks, basically the MS Blaster worm. And there was another worm that came out as well, but the MS Blaster worm is the larger that's being talked about. Basically, this worm exploits the DCOM exploit. It uses the DCOM exploit, which we discussed earlier, to gain access to your machine. Now, this runs on all versions of Windows except for 95 and 98, I believe.
And ME as
and
well.
ME, yeah, yeah. So it's all the NT family and XP all together, and. That worm basically allows you, that exploit basically allows you to get complete total access to the machine, and that's what the worm used to get access to the machine. And then after that, it basically started doing a few things. Machines were crashing, shutting down. One of the things I read was that Microsoft criticizes third-party code for Windows crashes, which is pretty funny. It's blaming everything on everybody else instead of themselves. And, here's what they have to say. You know, I got a comment. Linux is all third-party software. And we're not having any problems. So, I don't know. I don't know what that says, but it says something. You think about it. Basically they were just talking about some of the people that have contributed to their operating system. Now, see, this is a weird article because none of this talks about core operating system functionality, which is basically where the DCOM exploit sits at. But it's they're blaming other things where people attach, like, applications and stuff like that. I don't know. They attached Outlook. That's their own software, and that's pretty bad in itself. So, that's a comment from Microsoft there. I didn't blame the Blaster worm on it, but it's just, in general, it's just making third parties just making it more insecure. Yeah, the article I'm looking at right now actually just basically describes the slammer worm, which appears to still be doing damage out there. And, yeah, it's definitely hit quite a few people. One of the people that actually got hit was an Ohio nuclear power plant. No, it didn't cause the blackout. But, basically... I'll read it here. It says the breach did not pose a safety hazard, luckily. The Trouble plant has been offline since February of 2002 when workers discovered a 5-by-6-inch hole in the plant's reactor head. That was pretty bad. Moreover, the monitoring system called a safety parameter display system had a redundant analog backup that was unaffected by the worm. But at least one expert says that the case illustrates a growing cybersecurity problem in the nuclear power industry. Or, in my opinion, every industry that has it incorporated, where interconnection between plant and corporate networks is becoming more common and permitted by federal safety regulations. So it did get access to that computer. It, you know, caused problems with that computer. Didn't do anything as far as the power plant goes. But that says right there, okay, that's a real-world example of a worm that, you know, penetrated a place such as a nuclear power plant, and actually a few other places. I mean, there was a few city, I think it was Philadelphia City Hall, I'm not sure, but it was a few, there was a few other government operations and companies where the worm infiltrated and did what it did. You know, if it had a more targeted attack to doing something different that could possibly, you know, be even more malicious or problematic to a specific sector or a specific type of business or company, you know, who knows? But that's... another thing that we stress, you know, security. It's not perfect. There's no such thing as a perfectly secure machine. But, you know, come on, the MS Blaster worm to prevent it. You know, you don't want anyone to get into your NetBIOS ports. You shouldn't be letting anyone get into anything on your computer other than legitimate traffic. Maybe a web server should only allow just web traffic. You know, if it's an FTP server, whatever you're supposed to be allowing, allow it. And if it's not, don't. And that's... that kind of technology has been around for years, and it's only getting better and it's getting cheaper. And also, there was a patch for it. There's actually a patch for the patch. They had a patch that came out in mid-July for the DCOM exploit. Everybody knew that there was going to be a worm that was going to happen. I mean, it's just given. Usually when there's an exploit of, like, a critical level where a complete compromise happens, usually somebody modifies it and makes it to do, you know, allows it to do, you know, a few more funner things, I guess you could say, and sends it out, sees what happens. So, you know, there was a patch for that in mid-July, and then actually the patch didn't work, and then they had another patch for it towards the end of July. So that that was available, and we'll talk about how Microsoft feels like automating their patching because of this. So, you hanging in there, Rusty?
I'm hanging in there.
Okay. Feel free to talk at any time. Rusty's the first time he's been on the show, so I don't know if he knows the format, but this is kind of like, you know, anything goes. So if you have any comments so far, anything you thought about?
You're covering everything I was going to say because you're reading right from the source.
Sweet. Well, tell me how you patched yours. Actually, your family's.
My family's, yeah. The day I got word of the exploit, there was an advisory on the LSD-PL website. There wasn't working code out there at that time. But the day we actually got the code, I called my dad. I'm like, hey, get the IP addresses off your computer. I logged into those computers. I went ahead and I did a net start terminal services, and I logged into the desktop, and I was able to install the patch remotely by starting terminal services and creating accounts from the command shell it dropped me to. I mean, it's pretty scary that you have that kind of access, but in this case, it was used for a good purpose.
Yeah, yeah. Plus, it was, I mean, his family. I doubt his family is going to come back and, you know, attack him on that. I mean, nowadays you just don't know. We talked about once, you know, veering off subject a little bit, but we talked about once how somebody had, you know, refaced Kevin Mitnick's website after it was defaced, and he was kind of wary about, you know, telling Mitnick, being like, hey, you know, we had this, you know, this thing's going down with your site, and this is the problem, and I just refaced it, you know. But he figured that Mitnick, a fellow hacker... slash, you know, security person wouldn't have that type of response. I mean, if you're being helpful, why not? Okay. Well, I was reading, which is kind of interesting. The worm, I heard that they're actually tracking it down, and they think they know where it originated from. Doesn't mean they know who did it. This will be the first worm, actually, where I've heard of somebody actually getting close to tracking it down in recent years. Usually, you don't hear anything out, you know, in the open, code red, stuff like that, and I never heard anything about them tracking it down or even knowing where to even look. But that's just in the public, you know, who knows what could have happened behind the scenes. But this one, supposedly they're getting close. Maybe that's just because so many people are pissed off and they want to say that they can actually do something about it. Maybe they can't do anything about it. Maybe they don't know anything about it. I don't know. But that's the news. But one thing that was inside the message of the worm, which is pretty interesting, it says this. It says, Bill Gates, why do you make this possible? Stop making money and fix your software. You know, that's kind of funny because when they talk about, like, open source and stuff like that, and they say how since there's no money for research and development and there's no, you know, quality checking and stuff like that because it's, you know, old guys sitting in their bedrooms, you know, coding open source and submitting it to CVS sites and, you know, working on it. I mean, they've got less money to do it, and they've shown that they can collaborate very, very well, actually. There is a good level of collaboration. And the software does have bugs, and I mean, bugs are being reported. You don't think people want to attack Unix, Linux, well, not Unix, but Linux and BSD-type systems as well? I mean, of course they do, especially now that it's getting more popular. Do you think the hackers or, you know, crackers or criminals or whatever you want to call it, depending on what they're trying to do, you don't think they want to get access to that as well? Well, you don't see too many bugs like the ones that come out from Microsoft. Now, that's just the honest truth right there. That's going to tell you, I mean, it's not doing too shabby. So some of the stuff that I hear when they're starting to bash open source and stuff like that, I can't quite see the validity. It seems more like propaganda to me. So plus they have something to lose. So that was pretty interesting that was actually said in that message. Makes a good point. A lot of people wonder why these viruses are done, and or worms, and sometimes they're done because of, you know, people want fame or whatever, and they want to tell their buddies in their IRC channel that they released it. Or, you know, maybe it's like, you know, people get a kick out of bashing Microsoft because a lot of people use them and they have such crappy security. You know, I really don't have a problem with that. You may consider it illegal, and it may, you know, may make me upset if I have to go and work out in my company, you know, that has all these computers and I got all this downtime. I'll probably yell at the IT guy for not doing his job. But still. Well, since that whole debacle, Microsoft is being said as trying to figure out a better way to patch their systems, which means, you know, update it as fast as possible, which is like an automatic update a system. So they're thinking about doing that. Originally, you know, people were totally against that because you're like, what are you installing on my machine? And still, it's the same case. I mean, if they're automatically installing stuff on your machine, you know, is this a, you know, this could be a scare tactic in a way to push out the software. In a way, it'll fix the bugs, you know, as they can release patches, but they could also be installing whatever the heck they want. So that's another downside. But basically, it says the company is seriously looking at requiring future versions of Windows to accept automatic software fixes unless the user specifically refuses to receive them. So that's nice that they're at least thinking about having the feature in there to not receive them.
Already, I'd like to mention, I mean, if you go to Windows Update, if you run Windows, one of the critical updates that we'll install now is a Microsoft Windows Update client that runs on your system tray, and it pops up every couple of days and says, hey, do you want to install these updates? So they've already got their plan halfway there to be patching the systems. I mean, the next step is for them to have it automatically do it without asking you.
Is that different than the other one?
Yeah, it actually sits in your system tray, and it will pull the Windows Update site, and it will see, hey, you need these updates.
Oh, it actually opens the site? I remember the last one
just
sitting there.
It's not the site. It's just sitting there, and, I mean, it'll pop up, and you hit install. It logs into Windows Update and installs it if you hit OK.
Is that, because I remember they had one, they had a version 2, they had a version 4, and then, yeah, it had that, and you could specify it. Like, I usually specified it on a Windows machine, like, download these and then install them on specific times and then put that time. Is that the same thing, or is it a new version of that?
You know, I think it's a newer version. I think it's integrated with XP more than anything else. I haven't seen it on 2000 as much.
Oh, okay. So, yeah. So that's, you know, run it. I mean, anybody that's got Windows, hey, you know, do it. Patch your system. That's what it's all about. That's why it's there. You know, it doesn't matter if it's Microsoft or anybody else, you know. It doesn't matter. You need to do it. And so take that very seriously. I mean, it could cause you some downtime. It could lose some data. I mean, it could be anything. So it's just a very stressed thing that's been stressed for so many years, and people just haven't done it. You know, I subscribe to every emailing security list for every operating system I use, and then, you know, Slack, it just came out with one today. If you're running GDM, you need to patch it because it allows an attacker on the system to view all the local files, even if they don't have root privileges. And so I'm going to patch it. That's just something that happened to me today. So, yeah. So that's their stance on it. They're going to really, really, really work towards getting that system going. Because it's definitely causing them a lot of bad press and a lot of people downtime. So, one of the other interesting things I found, and it was posted on Slashdot, was I never knew about this site. It's called Netcraft, and basically, it's netcraft.com. Basically, you can go there and enter in a website, and periodically in the past, it's gone out and checked what types of, you know, what is it running, is it what's the operating system, what's the server, its IP address, things like that. And this one goes out, well, this specific post basically showed that when it went out and checked recently, as of August 15th, that Microsoft, and follow me here for a minute, Microsoft was basically running Linux OS, and the server was Akami Ghost, which, that's on a web server. That's a caching-type proxy server. And I saw some weird results. One of them said that it was running Microsoft IIS 6.0 on Linux, and I was like, whoa, you know? They trying to, like, port IIS to Linux, and then they, you know, tried to test it out. But I was reading a little bit more on how these stats come about on this website, and what most likely it is that there's a server running Akami Ghost on a Linux box that basically is doing filtering and proxying for the Microsoft Windows Update site. So, you know, and actually on this site, it shows a few other hosts over at Microsoft, and a lot of them are running Linux. I don't know, you know, obviously they're testing out Linux and seeing what their competition is, but there was quite a few that were running Linux. So if anyone doesn't think that they're seriously, you know, keeping tabs on what Linux is doing, well, you're wrong. They are, because it's a very viable solution in many ways. So that is the news on the blaster worm and some other interesting things I came about. Well, I'm going to go now, which we've been spending on most of our shows lately, the SCO news. Favorite pals over at SCO. And it's kind of funny because as time comes through and we keep reading more information, we're finding out that SCO's foothold is, which I don't even think it had one, but if it thought it had one, is slowly losing a lot of grip throughout all the information that's been passed. I guess I'll do a brief bit of information for people that may not know. SCO is a Intel Unix. And they're suing Linux, which is, well, they're suing IBM. Now they're starting to attack other Linux users and larger companies that run it. Suing them for using SCO code in the Linux operating system, and they want their rights to it. Now, nobody's proved that they actually have SCO code in the Linux operating system, and there's plenty of details we talked about on previous shows. So if you're really interested in that subject, it's been a big thing. Check out those shows. I usually put all the information I find. I stay pretty up to date on that. Well, there's a few developments that are happening now. A few things that are being found and being disclosed. One of the things that was disclosed was that the old SCO, in this article it mentions it as old SCO, maybe this is pre, you know, anti-Linux days, donated code to Linux. And there's a few quotes in here from SCO and what they thought about Linux at the time. And there's actually quite a few. I'm not going to read them all, but here's some of them. and this is, I'm reading straight from the article, so. Well, knock me over with a feather. It turns out that OldSCO, the Santa Cruz operation, also donated code to Linux. There's an article dated June 12, 2000 that tells us about their Linux distribution and their plans, which includes scaling it to the enterprise and Markitroids like to, as Markitroids like to call it. While SCO may be rolling out its Linux distribution long after Red Hat and Caldera hit the market with theirs, SCO is no open source Johnny come lately. The company offers support services to Caldera and Turbo Linux customers. In addition, the customers Tarantula middleware supports Linux as well. The Intel-based version of the Unix software that SCO will build for IBM. To run on their servers. SCO is expected to announce 32 and 64-bit versions of Linux with Intel-based servers, which will be available in the fourth quarter of this year. In early 2001, SCO plans to deliver a 32-bit internet infrastructure, an addition that will come bundled with a web server and other IP applications. The company is also working on a 64-bit edition for service providers, including ISPs and application service providers, which will feature special billing and management tools. The company is also expected to explore the following areas. Now, this is really important here. Building the Linux clustering capability to be in line with SCO's non-stop clusters technology, which scales to 12 or more boxes with advanced reliability for data and applications. Current Linux clustering technology is generally limited to 2 or 4 nodes. Beefing up Linux's symmetrical multiprocessing capabilities. Currently, the number of CPUs per Linux server is usually limited to 8. Unixware can run on servers with up to 32 CPUs. We'll get to that in a second. Managing multiple Linux servers as well as applications from a single console as if they were a single system, improving security and the availability of Linux to handle applications such as email and instant messaging, adding online support services and documentation. The article says, wait a sec, isn't that what paragraph 85 of SCO's original complaint was talking about? And didn't they say that IBM entered the picture? Without IBM entering the picture, Linux could never have scaled, the complaint said. For example, Linux is currently capable of coordinating and simulating performance of 4 computer processors. Unix, on the other hand, commonly links 16 processors and can successfully link up to 32 processors for simultaneous operation. That wasn't accurate, but it does give me an idea. Maybe new SCO needs to sue old SCO and leave the rest of us in peace. And basically, there's a lot of reading there, but basically it was showing that they supported Linux in the past. They're interested in contributing code and making things work. And it also was talking about SMP, which is the technology in question, or one of them, that SCO says that SCO code is in the Linux kernel. So, you know, who knows where that code came from. For a while, we thought a lot of it was pointed to come from a Caldera employee, which was actually SCO, a SCO company. So, you know, a lot of other facts are coming out that really say that it really takes what SCO's words have been, splattered out there and really is stripping away any validity that they may have had. So that's very interesting. And also, just another small note, SCO, their SCO Unix, they basically use Samba along with it to help integrate with Windows systems. And they use Samba 3 because Samba 3 allows Linux and Unix servers to replace Microsoft Windows NT domain controllers, and it also allows it to work in an Active Directory environment with Windows 2000 and replace those domain controllers as well, I believe. And basically, it says right here, one of the direct quotes from SCO is, at the end of the day, the GPL is not about making software free. It's about destroying value. And basically destroying the value of their code is what they're saying in their eyes. But the hypocrisy here is that they actually incorporate Samba 3 with the release of their open server product, and that allows them to basically have an edge, and they're using open source software. So that's a bit of hypocrisy as well. So, I'm glad this stuff is coming out. I'm glad that... See, that's the thing, is that there's a community of intelligent people out there, and computing actually has become, over the years, is becoming more political because it's being more integrated with your lives. And I'm glad there's a lot of intelligent people out there that are spreading the word, and this isn't something that corporate America can just pass over on someone that, you know, used to be the little guys, is now getting pretty big. Like we talked in the past about the car maker Tucker. If you've ever watched the movie Tucker, it describes a guy that innovated the car. He wasn't like Henry Ford. He didn't come out with the motor and the assembly line and stuff like that. But he innovated a lot of safety features and better features in the car that corporate America at that time took him out and basically stole his ideas and started interpolating, adding those to his to their cars as well, and you know, reaping the benefits. So, all right. Well, now we've talked about before. SCO has been attacking the Unix. Well, not Unix. I keep saying Unix. The Linux community, and basically they're sending out all sorts of information to companies that use Linux and are pressuring them to buy their licensing scheme to free them of any problems of running SCO code on Linux, which, however, is really expensive. Right now it's $700 per CPU license. You know, that's way more than what Windows charges for their operating system, and that's the whole operating system. This, they're talking about, you know, a few hundred thousand, maybe 10,000 lines of code, you know, and Linux is made up of, you know, millions of lines of code. So that's a cheap shot right there to even charge that much. But now, you know, it's more news about them actually going out and going into companies and sending them letters and stuff like that. Another interesting thing is just before the whole SCO debacle of them beginning this whole thing, the SCO group executives actually sold out 119,000 shares of their company. Since it filed the lawsuit. Okay, sorry. Since it filed the lawsuit, it has sold that many shares. Funny thing. Why would they sell those shares unless they thought that they might be in potential danger? You know? Maybe it is a good move to sell the shares. Let's just say they had a legitimate problem. They sold the shares to save some money, and then they'll buy back again later. But basically, that's some more evidence of showing that they knew they were getting something that, you know, might potentially affect them and might potentially affect them. It's not this is no small game. This isn't they're not dealing with a small group of people. There's large companies that are involved in Linux now. Let's see. Another interesting thing that I found was that since they've been charging for this license, typically their company has always been going a little bit non-profitable every year, and this is the first year where they've actually shown a profit. And ever since the SCO case and the Linux licensing, over 300 companies have signed up in the first 4 business days that the program was introduced. And on top of that, their company has shown a $3.1 million profit this quarter. And, you know, the article was saying that that's money that will be helping them to use it to continue their case. But it's two things. It shows that people are buying into it, and it shows that, you know, they're going to be obviously using that money for their case, because before they weren't being profitable. So, but the main thing I guess you could take away from it is that, geez, 300 companies signed up. The funny thing is, okay, 300 companies or more signed up. It hasn't even been proven.
Another anomaly I'd like to add to that was the pricing scheme that they introduced during the initial introduction to the pricing scheme for the SCO code. It was supposed to be discounted up to a certain date. So
yeah, it could change.
They haven't proven anything, and they're selling this. These customers going, you're going to get it for a discounted rate if you buy it now, but if you buy it later, the price is going to go up. They're sort of taking advantage of those companies, since it hasn't been proven that way, and these companies are feeling like, oh, well, I'm going to get a good net deal now. I'm not going to get it later, and nobody even knows what's really going on.
Yeah. So, you know, I'm kind of interested in what they actually sell SCO Unix for. I'm kind of curious what that goes for. $700 is pretty steep for just some code and other operating systems. I'm curious what they sell their own operating system. I don't think it'd be much more than $700.
I believe it's about the same.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, they're selling a whole operating system for $700, but then they want to, or, you know, somewhere around that, but they want to, you know, have people using Linux that they haven't proven use SCO code and have them pay $700 for that system as well. It's pretty ridiculous. So more SCO news is that SCO is blaming IBM for all the open source attacks. Okay, it doesn't take much common sense there. Open source is going to defend themselves. It's not IBM. It was here before IBM. It had nothing to do with IBM. IBM is bringing Linux, along with other companies, to an enterprise level, and that's it. I mean, they've contributed code. Of course, they're, you know, investing in the product and doing things like that. But it's been here forever. Well, not forever. It's been here way before IBM even came into the game. So, you know, there's a lot of people that have feelings with this. I mean, would you think if you coded 6,000 lines at the, you know, that's not even nothing in a program, but it's just that you coded 6,000 lines for an open source software and you released it, and all of a sudden, you know, all these companies are out there bashing open source and doing something like that. You don't think you're gonna have a feeling about that? I mean, how many people out there programmed for Linux? And on top of it, the audacity of some of the claims, you know, it just pulls you out of your seat to go out and say something about it. It doesn't take much under these circumstances to rile the opposition or the, you know, the original position of the people to say something about it. So SCO is really trying hard to put out what they can, but I don't believe that there's much validity and there's not much factually that they're coming out with. I did read a few interviews with Linus Torvalds. They did evaluate. There was this SCO presentation at a conference that they were at, and the presentation, it's called the SCO Forum 2003. And if you look it up on the internet, you can find the actual PowerPoint presentation that they used. I don't know if it's PowerPoint, but they used a presentation. And basically, it showed some of the infringing code. Well, the infringing code, it only showed the comments. It didn't actually show any of the code. But it showed some of the comments of the code, and then it would show some of the comments and a little bit of the Linux code, and showing how they looked exactly the same. And in some of those areas where they had code, Linus Torvalds had mentioned that they had gone through just, I don't know if it was just prior to the SCO case. Let's see, I'll read it right here. Let's see, I'll take a look here. Well, basically it said in a 2.6.x, which means any other subsequent revisions, they actually removed any of the code that they were talking about in that demonstration and replaced it. And what Linus had said is that they replaced it because it was such ugly code. So they replaced that code that they have been known to have been supposedly a part of this SCO deal. So that's, I mean, that's in the process. I mean, that can be done. I mean, the code can be shown, and it can be changed, and we can move on. And maybe somebody you're going to have to pay, you know, repercussions for having the code in at that time, depending on how the legal system determines if there's any infringement, by who has to pay damages. But all it has to do is be changed after that and move on, and you can have a SCO-free operating system. And like we spoke to the last show, we were talking about a program that's already out there. All it just needs is the SCO code, and it can basically recognize where that supposed code is in the Linux operating system and remove it and allow it to be replaced, all automated. It doesn't write its own code to replace it with, but there would be other code to replace it with that Linux people, open source writers, coders would have to write, and it'd be able to ratify any of the SCO infringing code on your machine if there is any. And we even spoke before is that some of this code will not be in your typical home desktop system. It's going to be an enterprise server running multiprocessing, running the JFS file format, which is IBM's file system. And, you know, so that's a lot of information. So I hope everyone followed it, but that's the SCO news for this particular show. So, did I leave anything out? Rusty, is there anything else that, any comments or?
No, Slip, you covered it.
Sweet. All right. Well, we're going to move into small bit of information. We talked about, at the beginning of the show, we talked about a small article that we had, me and Rusty had participated in on the, it's from New Times, actually, the Phoenix New Times edition, and it's on wireless war driving. And we have the article with us. Basically, the guy found our email addresses on azwardriving.com on the forums there, and used that to contact us, and then basically, you know, ask us some questions. And me and Rusty were kind of wary at first, like, oh, you know, what's this guy gonna write about? You know, are war drivers like taking over the world and causing terrorism and stuff like that? So, you know, we didn't know. And we're like, okay, well, you know, we'll just, you know, it can't hurt. We'll just give him, you know, we'll talk to him and we'll, you know, just be on the level and we won't talk about anything, you know, illegal or anything like that. I mean, war driving in itself isn't illegal. You know, anything that may follow, you know, penetrating wireless security can be illegal. But that wasn't the subject. And we decided to meet and stay as anonymous as we could. And we had that meeting.
Yeah, as anonymous as we could, according to the reporter, Jamie Magahern. It's kind of funny because we had an agreement with him that he would not use my last name, and he ended up using it in the article. I guess that just goes to show you that you really can't trust any member of the media, no matter what they tell you. In my case, it wasn't really that big of a deal, as we weren't doing anything illegal, and I'm not ashamed of what I do. It's kind of an interesting ordeal.
Yeah, and actually Rusty was in the DEFCON war driving contest and did pretty well there, despite some other weird things going on, like possible breaking of rules and interpretation of data. But otherwise, you know, we're not going to get into that. That was actually, you know, it was actually pretty fun. The people that participated, Rusty said it was pretty fun.
Yeah, basically we had 12 teams. I think we placed fourth, and there were a lot of issues with data and scoring, but that would be a whole show to go into that, so I think I'll skip that part.
Yeah. Okay, back to the article. So we ended up meeting one time with him, I did, and then we spoke, and he asked us a few questions, and we actually took him war driving. We piled him up in Rusty's car, and almost got hit by another car, actually, which is described in the article. You know, if you go to phoenixnewtimes.com, you'll be able to pick it up there. It's the previous article, so you'd have to click on that. And then, actually, if you listen to this show further along down the road, you can search previous articles. Look for Jim McCarron.
Jimmy Magahern, and the date of the article was the August 14th to 20th edition.
Geeks Gone Wild. Okay, so we met once, and we took a more driving, and basically we just drove around, and, well, how about you take it away, because...
We piled Jim in our car, and we went for a drive. We put the laptop in his lap, and we said, okay, here, take it away, and we drove throughout part of Tempe, Mill Avenue, and some side streets. We picked up probably about 60 or 70 networks in about 15 minutes' time. We talked to him about why we do this, you know. We pointed out that we like to point out, hey, all these wireless networks are vulnerable, and we want to say, hey, you know, by providing statistics, we can make people aware that they need to secure these networks, that that, you know, you're wide open, and by securing your network, you're going to make things better for everybody.
Yeah, and actually, Rusty, his website, if you go to, which is the best one to plug?
Just go to thefilevault.org/wardriving. It's all one word.
And, that's actually, you'll see the Slipknot shows are up there. And, I gave Rusty some space to host his website. But you'll find up there it shows a large map of Arizona. Not all of Arizona, but most of the Phoenix
mostly
and
the
surrounding.
Phoenix area.
Yeah. And what are the stats that you found from doing it?
I think we've got about 9,200 networks mapped in the Metro Phoenix area. About two-thirds of them are wide open with no sort of encryption. One-third are encrypted, and you know, the range of that map is probably about let's say 75 miles by 75 miles tall and wide.
Yeah, it's very, very large. And explain some of the equipment. What do you do? I mean, what is your equipment? What software are you running? Your wireless cards, antennas, stuff like that.
I use a little IBM ThinkPad laptop, and I also use a Compaq Armada laptop. As far as cards are concerned, I like the cards that have the external antenna connectors on them. I use a card by a company called Sineo. It's a high-powered wireless card. It has two antenna connectors on it, as well as an Orinoco-based card with one antenna connector on there. For software, I use a piece of software called Kismet. It's different from the Windows-based software for discovering wireless networks, which is called Network Stumbler, and the fact that it passively discovers networks. Instead of sending out beacons to connect to the networks, it's passively listening to all the radio waves in the 2.4 gigahertz range in the air, and it can pick those signals up that way.
Which the passively mode could considerably be non-obtrusive and be more along the lines of being less illegal.
Well, that's true to a point, but you also have to remember that when you're passively monitoring data, you also have the ability to passively log that data,
yeah.
which could be illegal if
you log the data and you're not
logging the data. Yeah, exactly.
Okay, and then go ahead and keep talking about the equipment, because I know you use some more stuff.
Yeah, we use a GPS unit. Any GPS unit will work as long as it has the capability to output in a format known as NMEA. The GPS, when it's in NMEA mode, it only spits out coordinates on latitude, longitude, and the speed you're going, and the laptop software that I use, Kismet, will pick up that coordinate when you detect the access point and log that. Later on, you can use that data to plot the points of a network. We also use antennas. There's a couple of kinds of antennas you can use. There's the omnidirectional antenna, which basically it's a 360-degree wave pattern. You can see radio signals in all directions, and then there are directional antennas, which they have a very narrow beam. It's more like shooting a gun. It goes far, but it's only going to cover a narrow area. What I like to do is use a combination of those antennas. I use the omnidirectional, and I use directional antennas on the sides of the car, so I pick up things that are in a large radius around the car with the omnidirectional, but not too large. It gives me the higher and lower networks than the networks that are further away as I drive by or detected by the directionals.
Okay. And on the site, thefilevault.org /war driving/, and it's in the folder war driving, you'll see a lot of that equipment, and describe to me your directional antennas, because those are pretty neat.
The directional antennas, one of them is a Andrew Panner Microceptor antenna. It's a commercial antenna used by wireless ISPs. Usually they'll use it for point-to-point wireless networks. An antenna like that, if you have one on each side, you could probably establish maybe a 20-mile wireless link, because it's highly directional, and it works really well for going one direction. The other antenna is a Cantenna that I constructed myself. It's almost as good as the commercial antenna, believe it or not, and that can be built using a soup can. The dimensions of the measurements are very specific. You've got to do it right, and you use ham radio connectors known as AN connectors, and you use low-loss cable. LMR times microwave is probably what you want to use, because up in the 2.4 gigahertz range, you're going to lose a lot of signal if you use anything less. So we like to use LMR 100 because it's flexible and for short runs, but if you're going to be running longer runs, you're going to want to use LMR 400 cable, just because every 3 feet of cable you lose like you lose 1 dB of what we like to call gain, and it's not a good thing to lose that signal.
Yeah, and also the GPS is connected to the serial port on the laptop, right?
Yes.
And the GPS what captures a single signal, isn't it GPSD?
Yeah, GPSD.
And then transfers that to Kismet.
Yeah, GPSD is actually an open source piece of software. It listens on the serial port, and actually Kismet connects to GPSD on a specified port and captures that data. It's networkable, so you could actually telnet to that port, and you can view the raw data coming through GPSD.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting when you war drive with a GPS, because as you're watching Kismet and you're watching it do its work, you're also watching the speed of your car. And when you slow down, it's GPS is kind of fun just in general.
Yeah, hopefully you're watching the road more than the speed of the car.
Well, yeah. Okay. And do you use combinations of the wireless cards, right?
Yes. I use the Sineo card with the two antenna jacks as well as the Orinoco at the same time. I threw the laptop in the back seat now. Yeah, I hook up all my antennas. That way I don't have to worry about looking into the laptop. You can actually configure it to speak to you using open source software known as Festival. It's a speech synthesis program. So if you really want to know what your network says, you can have the laptop speak it to you. You don't have to worry about looking at your screen.
Yeah, I was reading about that. I didn't enable it, but yeah, that's pretty neat. Festival is pretty cool.
Yeah, it's
cool program. And then you power the laptop. You just have like a cigarette lighter outlet.
Yeah, I just use a power inverter for the laptop. That way I don't have to worry about batteries.
Cool. And let's see. You're also involved in the Worldwide War Driving.
Yeah, the Worldwide War Drive is an annual event that takes place every year. And basically it's a coordinated event across the world. It's organized by Chris. He goes by the name Romer. The website is worldwidewardrive.org, and they actually just put up all the maps. I don't have any exact numbers, but there are quite a few networks discovered across the world, and they actually put up maps of every coordinator's area this year. I think we had, I want to say about 6,000 that we found in Phoenix during the Worldwide War Drive this year, and that was just between myself and one other person.
Very cool. Okay, all right, back to the article. This is kind of like, you want to know kind of this stuff before you even get in the article. That's to kind of get a stance on, the type of experience that Rusty has and stuff like that. So we did one interview, and we took him out for a drive. He basically saw the machine in action, and they also asked us for a picture of us on the cover. And at first I declined, and I think, you were a little wary about it. And our main point with the news is, we've talked about it before, is that you don't really know, these people, and you don't know how they're going to portray you. Luckily in this article we weren't portrayed as, like, people that were doing illegal things. And we specifically were, showing the points along the line of, like, would you do something like this? Would you try to break in other people's networks? Would you try to, couldn't people come over to a government, like an FBI building and take it over? And, like people with that knowledge could go to a government building and maybe there's an access point open with no weapon, exploit it. Yeah, if those conditions were there, can they take over the world? No, stuff like that. But just now getting away from that point, was there any specific quotes or anything that you wanted to go into?
Well, first I want to start out. It's kind of funny. I think that the idea that the editors of the New Times had of this article was slightly different than that of the writer. If you notice the captions and the title, Geeks Gone Wild, War Driving Hackers Take the Revenge of the Nerds to the Street. And you actually
I didn't understand that, Revenge of the Nerds.
Yeah, you go through the article and you read about it, and it talks about, that we want these networks secured, and it gives you a pretty broad overview. The author did a decent job of making us look like we actually, were interested in securing these networks and not hacking the world, which was pretty nice of him, even though he used my last name. But
Yeah, we'll do the rants at the end, actually.
Yeah, okay.
go ahead and continue. If there's any specific quotes you'd like to read or anything like that, he pretty much picked the quotes that I would like him to read.
Yeah, we sent him a lot of links. I like how he explained that war driving was derived from war dialing, which was made popular by, say, war games, the act of dialing up phone lines, seeing if there's a modem on the other end.
Yeah, so at least there was some education to this, and we tried to provide as much information as possible.
And another interesting thing is he went into the whole geek culture with geek T-shirts.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he mentioned, you had your...
I had the Chicks Dig Unix shirt on, and you had the RTFM.
No, I had the STFU.
The STFU, okay.
Which means shut the, up. And, he actually explained that he had asked me, he goes, oh, what's that pick, what's that, what does that mean? And hoping it to be some, technological related thing. And I was like, no, it means, shut the fuck up. And, I said, sorry right after that. And he mentioned that in the article, but, it was kind of funny. So he did some, he's trying to do some research on the culture. He did some other quotes of mine. One of them that I'm trying to remember from memory here is that, there's a thin line between knowing the information and using the information. A lot of people know the information on how to do certain things. Let's just say you know how to secure something, which means you also know how to break into it because you know what caused the issue in the first place. Some people know the theory of how to break into it, but some people actually know how to do it. And I said there's a thin line between that, and I basically said, once you cross that line, depending on what it is, you know, it can be criminal. And one of the things in here that, because he had asked the question, you know, could this lead to terrorist activity, you know, kind of leading along those lines, and I said, I basically said to the effect that, well, for one, it would have already happened by now. I mean, you would have already seen some sort of exploitation of this by now. And then the other thing was, I think people that typically, like, do war driving, for first off, it's a sport. I mean, it's actually like fishing, you know, you go try to find the fish in the pond. It's a sport, first off, and then secondly, it's for security. I mean, it can build statistical analysis of the current state of wireless security, default you know, access point settings, if they're encrypting traffic, stuff like that. But I basically said to the point that for the most part that you will not find people that do war driving. Either they're too smart to not do something like that because it's not going to really lead them anywhere, and they don't really care about your Hotmail account, you know, you reading your email at your home, you know, somebody's home data. And they're probably too nerdy, was the other thing that I said, or geeky maybe is the other word to use to do it, because it's just, you know, they're not looking for world domination. They just want to go out and, you know, find access points and see what's going on, see if they can find it, you know, see how many they can. It's a sport, and it's also a security tool. So do you have anything to...
I've got a lot, but I don't know where to start.
All right, I'll let you start.
Okay, I'll start. Yeah, I think that the type of person that's more likely to connect to a network, maybe like, you know, a kid who wants wireless access, maybe someone has a business and they need to get in real quick, and they're like, hey, you know, there's these wireless hotspots. I mean, people don't get me wrong, people do log into these access points and they do use them, but the people that are actually out there saying, hey, these things are insecure, these things are wide open, they're more likely to have other means to get on.
Yeah, they probably have four access points or testing out of the house and they did it themselves.
Home.
Yeah. I'll let you continue on.
Why don't you take it over for a second?
Okay. Yeah, because we're sifting through the news article here. Well, one of the things, okay, I'll get to the complaints that we had. Basically, when we released the article, we saw that Rusty's last name was on it, which that was totally bogus, was totally not supposed to be there. We were kind of battling with the picture idea. They didn't end up asking me for a picture. Rusty decided to do a picture and didn't reveal himself. Just kind of like, you know, kind of like a picture showing him and his laptop, but you saw his laptop instead of his face. I actually asked Meme. I'm kind of steering, but there's so much information. I asked Meme, who's been on previous shows, and actually if you go to oldschoolfreak.com, you'll see a lot of Meme's artwork about how she would think would be best portrayed as like a cover picture. And her idea was actually showing two people holding laptops, but you're looking at pavement, and you see the shadow of them on the pavement. And I was thinking of the idea of throwing some, like, antennas down there on the ground, or, like, all their... Or maybe it's two guys' shadows, and there's all this, like, laptop equipment and wireless cards and stuff on the ground, stuff like that. The thing that we noticed was Rusty's last name was published in the article. And on top of that, we also noticed that my nickname was wrong. I'm Slip Mode and not Slip Node. And I kind of complained about that because, you know, every time I had talked to him via email, it was my email address, and then the name is Slip Mode. And also, he spouted, he plugged my site, which I was like, oh, cool, you know, because maybe I'll get some more listeners, and, you know, I could, you know, involve more interaction, and, you know, it's always good to have more listeners in the show and spread the word and stuff like that. But the show, the website he put down was slipnet.com, and my website is slipnet.org. So, you know, I was, those kind of basic things in journalism, I was kind of upset about that. And I sent a letter off to, you know, feedback at thephoenixnewstimes.com. And we also included, one thing, too, is that he said I refuse to say my real name and insist on me using my nickname. And the reason that I did that was because it was for fame. And I was like, you know, it's always cool to be in an article, okay? Nothing wrong with kind of being excited about, you know, being in a news article or, you know, having some sort of publicity, you know, about doing something you enjoy. You know, nothing wrong with that. But the thing that I didn't enjoy is that the main reason that I didn't give out my name is because I didn't know how he was going to write the article, first of all. And I didn't know how people were going to interpret reading the article, second of all. And this isn't far-fetched, okay? So if you think this sounds weird, I don't. You know, there's lots of people that read the New Times. And, you know, there are people, you know, like federal agents that are just normal people, too, in themselves. And they pick up their publications that they like reading. And maybe they like reading, one guy likes reading New Times. And then all of a sudden they have a name in there. It doesn't say that anybody did anything illegal. But now, you know, there is a name to question if somebody exploited or did something wrong with wireless. You know, they're going to call up Rusty and say, look, you did this article, you're not a suspect, but hey, you know, we want to know who's in the community. We want to know who you might think do this. You know, who's got that kind of access. We want to have you talk to this guy and bring him in. You know, that's not...
it's a real hassle.
Yeah, I'm telling you right now, that's not far-fetched. So, and it's just an invasion of privacy. So that was another thing that we had all complained about. And then basically Jim had written an email back and straight up admitted that it was sloppy journalism. He didn't say anything about the last name, though. He did tell me it was sloppy journalism. He was trying to rush the story out. And, you know, he admitted to that. But, you know, these journalists, you know, when they write a story, it's like their portfolio. You know, and it is a portfolio, and I may be, you know, making an accusation here, but, you know, there is a bit of wanting to say, like, oh, I wrote that story, you know, I was able to get the facts, you know, I got their names, you know, a good reporter is supposed to be getting all those facts on all those things, you know, some guy's giving out an alias, I mean, you know, unless they specifically had some sort of anonymous person that they agreed would give information based on anonymity, you know, otherwise they're going to try to get as much information as they can and put it out there. So for their own, you know, for their own gains, you know, and I don't know this guy and he may not be like that, but he may be like that. So that's, you know, that's a lesson to, you know, be wary about, 'cause it's you, it's your ideas, it's your thoughts, it's your story, and somebody else is going to write it. It's kind of weird.
And it's not going to be 100% accurate, and if it's not going to be 100% the truth, then sometimes that can be rather frustrating.
Yeah. So definitely, you know, watch what you say, watch what you do. You know, I know there's other people out there that, you know, get stories done and, you know, talk about things and spread information. Be very careful. And when it comes to the types of things that we've talked about, you know, security or internet or vulnerabilities or, you know, anything like that, even just your own political opinion. You know, you could very well, you know, get very, you know, harassed and have things happen to you. We haven't had anything happen to us, okay? And I'm not trying to put out the fear factor. I'm just trying to, you know, educate you on things you need to think about probably before, if you're in the situation, you know, what to do. So, all right. Well, if you don't have anything else to add...
I've got a couple more errors in the article I can point out. Actually, there was... one part in the article where Jim had mentioned that Slip Mode was riding shotgun, when in fact he was riding shotgun. It's kind of funny how he's willing to put us in the situation of we're driving and holding the laptop when we really put the laptop in his lap. And
I didn't even pay attention to that. That's right.
You know, I mean,
yeah, he was actually had the laptop in his hands.
We're calling him on a theory.
I know Jim listens to the show probably because he knows the site and he's listened to previous shows, so.
Yeah, and the point of this isn't to rip you, Jim, if you're listening to the show.
Yeah. We did say that you did not make us out to be like illegal hacksaws that are trying to take over the world. So, I mean, we appreciate that. I mean, time and time again, you know, that's done very well in another way where things are, you know, people are being writing articles like that. So.
And the last thing was I pointed the article out to Chris, who organizes the Worldwide War Drive, and he's got a general bad or distemper for reporters in general because of all the bad stories that have been written about war driving, and they accidentally got his name wrong, and they said his name was Router, when his handle online is Roamer, and it turned into a pretty big joke on IRC. We kept calling him Router all day long.
Oh, yeah.
It was pretty hilarious.
So, yeah. All right. Anything else?
No, I don't have anything else, Slipknot.
Okay. Slipknot, buddy. Get it right. Sweet. Okay. Well, that is that's our show. Hope you enjoyed it. Lots of information. Glad to have Rusty on here. He's definitely educated guy in the field when it comes to wireless and other things as well. So hope to see him back possibly in the future. And feel free to leave any comments on the forums on slipknot.org. I posted the link to the article. Actually, yeah, if you want to go there, on slipknot.org, in the forums, you'll find a link to the article, the things that we had pointed out wrong, except for the riding shotgun one. I forgot about that. Actually, I didn't even pay attention to that. And you can put your comments there. You can talk about anything else you'd like there. That's what it's all about. And, you know, spread that word back to the show and just keep putting information out. That's what it's all about. All right. Well, I'm going to sign out, and I'll see everyone in 2 weeks. This is Slipknot signing out.
And this is Rusty signing out.
And we will see you in 2 weeks. We'll be right back.